Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro. Today, cultivating your crafty self.
What do you think? Are you getting kindergarten flashbacks?
I am, except that I'm missing the smell of Elmer's glue.
Plus, we'll hear how nostalgic indie musicians are bringing back the cassette tape, and how quilting gives a group of hardworking women in Mendocino County a break from family obligations.
No husband, no kids, only women here. It's good.
It's a special arts and crafts edition of the California Report. If the very thought of Black Friday has you bracing for retail warfare ahead of the holidays, maybe it's time to rethink your approach. Put down your credit cards and pick up a tool to create something with your own hands. Today on the California Report, we're celebrating creativity with an eye to the fact this is the season for giving. And sometimes, presuming proper execution, the best gift is something you make from the materials you have at hand. It turns out we have a resident expert working alongside us in our newsroom. Kelly Wilkinson, when she's not covering Occupy protests, creates crafts on the weekend and blogs about it, and has recently published a book, Weekend Handmade, that throws down the gauntlet to the most klutzy among us. We sat down for a cup of tea recently at her home in San Francisco, where she told us she's been working on creative projects her whole life.
I am from actually a super creative, kind of crafty family. Actually, my dad was a journalist and my mom was such a creative force. And my parents moved out to the country and renovated a barn having absolutely no idea what they were doing. And we were that family definitely that always made the Christmas gifts for each other.
It sounds like a, you know, pop psychology almost. Dad was a journalist. Mom right. was crafty. And here you are, a crafty journalist.
I know. It is. It's a very straight line, I guess, from what they did and how I grew up to doing this. I started out as a reporter and a journalist, and I would do that, and then I would get really kind of frustrated because it wasn't creative enough. And so I cycled through working at a knitting design company and making a line of aprons and working at a jewelry, all interspersed with these reporting jobs. And now it does feel like this much more integrated life. This book really sort of pulled it all together.
Well, here, let's open this book now. I was taken with this bit here at the end of the introduction where you say that for many people, time or the lack thereof is a powerful deterrent, and that you've tried to remove that hurdle with these projects. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that time. So many people, I'm sure, flipping through this book will say, oh, this all looks lovely, but who has the time?
Right. I mean, it is definitely something that you need to want to do. I have so much admiration for people who quilt and do these incredibly time-consuming projects, but I'm just more of a kind of instant gratification crafter. So the idea with the book was to come up with projects that have a certain look and a kind of aesthetic that people want to make, and the bonus is that they don't actually take that long to make.
It also seems like you're very much paying attention to the natural world around you, that you're finding the beauty and the design in very simple things, even walking the dog.
Right. There is actually the book is divided into three different chapters, and it's based on the name of my blog, which is Make, Grow, Gather. And so one whole chapter is grow projects that are, as you say, really inspired by walks and nature. And I mean, I live here in San Francisco and I take the dog for a walk and I can be within these parks really close to my house and gather wildflowers for this pressed flower lanterns or pine cones for this kind of chandelier project. Once you start thinking in that way and looking in that way, there is this whole, literally, this whole world of materials that opens up for you.
Well, let's make something.
Let's do it.
Okay, I have to break in here with a little side commentary, especially for those of you thinking there's a reason you don't own a pair of fabric shears or bake your own bread. I know.
I have to warn you, I have two left feet for my hands. I wasn't good at this in kindergarten, so... I may not be good at it now.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see. It's a challenge. I love that. I love that you don't consider yourself crafty. Okay, so we were going to make these pressed flower luminaria, is what they're called in the book. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is cut four of these rectangles of wax paper. And this is just regular,
This particular project couldn't be easier. You take flattened and dried flowers and leaves and arrange them inside the folded over wax paper.
What do you think? Are you getting kindergarten flashbacks?
I am, except that I'm missing the smell of Elmer's glue.
When you run a hot iron over the packet, the wax paper melts together, and the fauna inside looks like art. Seriously, it's pretty. Paste four of these together with decorative tape, and your friends will think you're channeling Martha Stewart.
And we have a lantern.
Oh, check it out.
I think we should really actually light a candle, because that gives it the really nice...
Yeah.
Sort of.
Wow.
Nice job. So are you a crafting convert?
Let's say I'm an agnostic verging on hopeful.
I'll take it.
Many of the projects in Weekend Handmade are just that simple. Others, not so much. Kelly keeps bees and makes her own honey, for instance. But the book really does invite you to try something, anything, and possibly discover a new way to unleash your creativity. And if you want to try to make the lanterns we worked on yourself, you can download instructions at our website, californiareport.org. If you're old enough, you remember making mixtapes. If you're not old enough, there were these things called cassettes. They must have them in a museum somewhere or in your dad's garage. But now some do-it-yourself musicians are rediscovering the romantic magic of this old technology. Jefferson Beavers has more from Fresno.
If your iPod provides the soundtrack to your life these days, you probably haven't thought about the cassette tape lately. The Fresno band, Quiet Americans, recorded its debut album, Medicine, on an old-fashioned reel-to-reel tape machine, chosen specifically for its wobbly, imperfect warmth. Releasing the medium-fidelity album on cassette tape was a natural choice for singer-songwriter Luke Giffen.
It's much cheaper than doing vinyl, so it's great for a band that's starting out or a band that is still trying to get a name for themselves.
Recently, the Quiet Americans played a show at Audi's Olympic Tavern in Fresno, where they sold copies of their new cassette. Among the 20 and 30-somethings outside the bar, nostalgia for cassette tapes mixed with bewilderment about the format's resurgence.
My parents, that's all they had, was just a big giant row of cassettes.
I don't even know where I could find a cassette player that would work.
I made a lot of mixtapes for a lot of girls.
I don't think I would purchase a cassette tape. I wouldn't have anything to play it on.
Sony quit producing its iconic Walkman in 2010. Also last year, Lexus became the last company to phase out tape decks in cars sold in America. And just a few months ago, the Oxford English Dictionary retired the phrase cassette tape from its venerable pages, making room for new digital age words like sexting and cyberbully. Another local band, Achievement House, put out its debut EP on cassette. The band's drummer, Daniel Schultz, founded the Coat Track Records Cooperative last December. Coat Track has helped 5 artists release albums in the past year, 4 of them on handmade, personalized cassette tapes.
A lot of it goes back to the idea of the mixtape, the idea of something that was made for you. Somebody took the time to sit down and create this one thing specifically for you.
Schultz makes tapes in his dining room, a space he and his girlfriend call the analog room. The walls are lined with books, vinyl records, cassette tapes, and a collection of vintage film cameras. Schultz spends hours at his dining table assembly line. He dubs cassette tapes one by one, he cuts out the album art with an X-Acto knife, and then he hand assembles the final packaging. This song is from the Fresno band The Fay Rays. On a recent evening, Schultz dubbed copies of their album, Strange Confessor.
This is the Telex Copy It. This is the high-speed tape dubber that I have.
Schultz got his tape dub machine for free from a friend's grandfather, a pastor who used the Copy It to duplicate recordings of his sermons.
So this is a 45-minute album, 22 and a half minutes a side, and it'll do this A side of the tape in less than 2.5 minutes.
Established indie artists like the Mountain Goats and Of Montreal have recently released albums on cassette, and small upstart cassette labels have sprung up in cities like Los Angeles, Oakland, Fort Collins, Colorado, and Middlefield, Connecticut. But some critics think tape should stay dead as far as music is concerned. One blogger for SF Weekly even called cassette lovers a bunch of nostalgic hayseeds. Others aren't quite as harsh. Eric Peters has recorded indie artists for more than a decade as a sound engineer at Fast Track Studios in Fresno. He likes the cassette tape aesthetic, but not the sound.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd want to personally go back to cassettes as a format. I think I'd rather have vinyl if that was the case, just in terms of fidelity.
Rewinds. Back to the Races, side B. What's that?
At Coat Track Records, the DIY quality of cassette tapes, not the fidelity, matters most to Schultz. He hopes the format will inspire artists everywhere to ditch major record labels, buy a secondhand tape recorder, and start putting out music on their own terms. For the California Report, I'm Jefferson Beavers in Fresno.
Generations of women have been telling stories in fabric with quilts. Lisa Morehouse paid a visit to one quilting bee in Mendocino County's Anderson Valley. Many of the members emigrated to work in the local apple orchards and vineyards.
In the parking lot behind Anderson Valley Elementary School, there's a portable classroom painted institutional brown. Inside, it's filled with life. 6 women sit in front of sewing machines at tables piled with fabric in every color. Throughout the day, more women come and sew and talk. They're all members of Los Hilos de la Vida, or Threads of Life. Maria Hernandez, a woman of deep faith, spent a year making a 6-foot quilt of Jesus.
Es una de las cosas más importantes que he hecho en mi vida. Is the most important in my life, this quilt.
She sewed a flowing satin robe and used strips of fabric and metallic thread to symbolize blood and water pouring from his heart.
Qué preciosísima.
In 2003, the school got federal funding for a program combining parenting classes and family literacy. Project director Molly Johnson Martinez spent a couple years taking a hands-on approach to teaching. And then she met a quilter.
I thought, ha, this is it. We'll have a quilting bee. Everybody will get together and complain about their kids, and then we'll have teachable moments.
She found all of her participants just wanted to sew.
They just wanted to have their creative time because they'd never had it. They'd been working in the field since they were, you know, second grade level.
When the women started exhibiting the quilts, they had to use their developing language skills to talk about their work. In 2009, they published a book describing their art in Spanish and English.
Everybody, every time is very happy here.
Ana Carrillo, an early member, recruited her mother and sister.
And the stress, no mass stress, no more stress, no work, no husband, no kids, only women's here. It's good.
Fabric and machines are donated. Johnson Martinez estimates about 75 women in the Anderson Valley have made quilts, and they've sold hundreds of them, from $50 to over $1,000 each. Quilters start with a backing fabric, then place a layer of batting on top. Then they select fabrics that speak to them and design a top like a collage. Many quilts tackle serious topics like alcohol abuse and deportation. Maria Hernandez sewed a graphic depiction of an abortion, an image she hopes dissuades young people from having sex. The social commentary surprised Johnson Martinez at first.
I was expecting a quilting bee.
But she says it was a natural outcome.
That's what art does. It captures a moment, an epic in people's lives. It's a snapshot.
A recurring topic is the U.S.-Mexico border. She shows a large-scale quilt by Carmela Valdivia.
This is a piece called The Train of Death.
It depicts abandoned immigrants who died of heat and asphyxiation in a train car. Another common theme is family. Ángeles Segura made a quilt about the birth of her oldest son in a busy Mexican hospital. While in labor, she was told to wait in line.
And there were more ladies in front of me, so you need to wait until it's your time. Even, well, it was an emergency. I just get my little boy in my hands.
You caught your own baby.
I caught my own baby, yeah. It was very, wow.
On the quilt, a distorted woman's face cries red tears, and her two hands reach below her skirt for her newborn. That quilt and about a dozen others are on display at a local coffee shop. Customer Christine Bindrup says art can connect the Anderson Valley's different populations.
You may be standing next to somebody that appears completely different and has grown up in a completely different background, and yet you see this work of art, and it may bring conversation where before you would not have spoken with that person before.
Los Hilos quilts have shown in California and across the country. Next year, in a show called Textiles of Exile, North Carolina's Gregg Museum will put these story quilts on display.
Everybody has art in their hands. Just let them go, let them to your imagination. It's huge.
Ángeles Segura says this kind of creative expression is addictive. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in the Anderson Valley.
To see a slideshow of some quilts and the women who make them, head to californiareport.org. Plenty of things, handmade or not, come from California. We'd like to see what your photographic eye focuses on. Share your photos of the Golden State with us, and you could win an iPad. This week, we're looking for photos that best reflect the theme Made in California. To find out more and see some of the terrific photos already submitted for this contest, visit californiareport.org and look for the link to Only in California. One quintessentially Californian creative couple, Charles and Ray Eames. No doubt you've sat in one of their chairs and seen them in magazines and offices everywhere, but the Eames did a lot more than design fabulous chairs. This dynamic duo's creative spark lit up fine art, architecture, industrial design, graphic design, even film. Take, for instance, the classic educational short called Powers of Ten.
We begin with a scene 1 meter wide, which we view from just 1 meter away. Now, every 10 seconds, we will look from 10 times farther away, and our field of view will be 10 times wider.
A new documentary, Eames, the Architect and the Painter, explores the arc of their professional lives. It opened in Los Angeles last week and will open in the San Francisco Bay Area December 2nd. Jason Cohn, one of the filmmakers, joins us to talk about the documentary. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start with a clip. Here's narrator James Franco describing the Eames Design Studio, established in Venice, California, in 1943.
For four decades, 901 Washington Boulevard in Venice Beach, California, was one of the most creative addresses on earth. Dozens of gifted young designers cut their teeth within the walls of the studio. But the vision for the office came from the top.
It was a Renaissance studio. It was a place where many young designers who came through there were encouraged to, work on things that interested them. You know, they worked on graphic design. They worked on architecture. They built one of the most famous pieces of residential architecture in America, the Eames House. They did corporate work for Westinghouse and IBM, and they did exhibitions for the U.S. government, the Indian government. I mean, it was just a really incredibly productive place.
The Eames name is the brand that brings in the business, brings in the contracts, and more specifically, the name Charles Eames. And that's another issue that you address in a very moving way. Ray Eames kind of fell into the background. She didn't have Charles' charisma, but she had a big, big set of talents. I'm wondering if you can explain for people who maybe think of Charles Eames when they think of the Eames, what it was that Ray brought to the table.
I think the dialogue, the back and forth between them and between all the other people in the office as well, is really what made the work so great. But I do think that Ray brought really an unparalleled kind of eye for color, for form. She just seemed to have had an absolutely natural sense of what sort of elevated something from being a functional design to making it a work of art, you know, an Eames design, something which doesn't just work as a piece of furniture or as a film or whatever, but something that really is satisfying on an emotional level, at a human level. I'm not sure that Charles alone would have reached that height had it not been for Ray.
They met when they were living in Michigan, but they moved to the West Coast and they set up their studio in Venice. Was there something about Southern California that influenced their work or gave them the space to work in the way they did?
You have to look at when they went there. They went there around 1940, and you know, it was becoming at that time a counterbalance to the power of New York and the East Coast. And I think that a lot of things that they were interested in were there. Hollywood filmmaking was there. They were interested in things like aeronautics, and aeronautics was there. So it appealed to them, and I think that they kind of wanted to get away from Michigan where they were. I think they were actually looking for a place where they didn't know a lot of people and where they could really just kind of hunker down and focus on the work that they had in front of them.
They were so playful. You really get a sense that they were having fun in whatever project they approached, even if it was a commercial product.
Yeah, they brought delight to the work that they did. And they said that design should be functional, but you have to think about what you mean by functional. Why shouldn't delight be a function of design? I mean, why, you know, there's this sort of idea that comes out of European modernism, that form has to follow function and things shouldn't have colors or any extraneous design. And they didn't really approach it that way. I mean, I think that they did. If you look at their furniture design, it is very simple. The lines are very clean. But they also wanted people to have choices. There's no reason that something should only come in the color black. So, you know, their plastic chairs were made so that the dyes could be, you know, integral to the fiberglass, and they made them in dozens and dozens of colors, and it was like a rainbow. They got a little bit of guff for it. You know, they were considered, to not be good modernists because they did some of the stuff. They made children's furniture with hearts in it, and, you know, you don't put hearts in your furniture if you're a modernist. But they didn't really care about that stuff.
Do you think that delightfulness goes some way towards explaining why they've really managed to stay current? I mean, you think of those chairs, you could put them in a living room today and it would still look smart and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, no, they fit in any, you know, they fit in any environment. They humanized modernism in a way that nobody really had done before.
Let's hear another cut from the documentary. This is Seaford Petros, director of the Center of Architecture and Design at the Library of Congress. He's really summing up the magnitude of their accomplishment.
What furniture designers ever have produced 40 to 50 pieces of furniture that have been in production for 5 decades. But the other thing is the sheer joy, that aspect of play. No one else, I think, had that combination of the pragmatic and the aesthetic.
You obviously went into this documentary knowing a lot about the Eames. Were there any things that surprised you as you were making this documentary?
Well, the thing that was really pleasing about the film was to start out with a subject that you know is, you know, visually beautiful. We knew there was a lot of material. What we didn't realize is sort of the depth of the ideas behind their work. And that was I think that was the most satisfying thing about making the film, is that the more you know about them, you find that there's a very profound philosophy at work in their design. What they were doing was a kind of problem solving, and that process is probably more important than any chair that they made or any film that they made. It was that process of how do you approach a problem? How do you approach design? What is design really, you know, what can it be? What should it be? I think the best practitioners of design adhere to it.
Thank you for coming in here and talking with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
Jason Cohn is one of the filmmakers of Eames, the architect and the painter, which opened in L.A. last week and will open in the San Francisco Bay Area December 2nd. The documentary also premieres on TV December 19th as part of the PBS American Masters series. That's our show for this week, but before we go, on an upcoming show, we'll be featuring stories of tradition, and we want to hear about yours. If there's something you do to celebrate the season, remember a loved one, or mark the passing of another year, tell us about it by going to californiareport.org. Look for the link to the Public Insight Network. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocha. Seal Muller is our technical producer, with additional engineering by Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohn, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Rigoberto Hernandez and Rebecca Wolfson. Our producer is Victoria Malione. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.